Hello, good morning, and welcome. It's Friday, the 12th of June, 2020, and we're back with episode 155. I am super excited for today's episode because of the wonderful guest we've got. It's none other than the CEO himself of DeepMap.ai, James Wu. Not only is it an incredibly fascinating, wonderfully engaging conversation, it is by far and away the longest conversation I've ever had with a guest, clocking in at something like an hour and 10 minutes. So I hope you've got a great commute. Well, wait, hold on. Nobody's actually commuting. So scratch that. I hope you have a wonderful place to sit for an hour and 10 minutes, nice and comfy in your home, presumably. And because I think you're going to really love this episode. It's just fantastic stuff. Before getting started, though, just a friendly reminder, if you are a fan of this podcast, please do be sure to head over to Apple Podcasts and drop me 5 stars and a written review. These reviews really do matter a lot to me, so seriously, just take a moment, please, and drop those 5 stars, if you would, please. Or, frankly, leave me 1 star if you're not a fan, and let me know why. What else? Yeah, obviously, please continue to share this podcast with your friends and colleagues, and don't forget, if you are in the strategy consulting space and you have any need for assistance with anything whatsoever in the autonomous vehicle or mobility space, be sure to head on over to hogandco.com. That's hoagandco.com. And don't forget, while you're there, click the blue banner at the top to take our Consumer Acceptance of Autonomous Vehicles Global Survey. It's really fascinating stuff. And I think you're going to learn a lot about yourself in the process just answering the questions. All right, then. Let's get started. A bit of background I want to share with you both about Dr. James Wu as well as DeepMap. So James is the co-founder and CEO at DeepMap. Prior to founding DeepMap, he built his career at Baidu, Apple, and Google. At Baidu, he served as the principal architect for the self-driving team. And at Google, he was a core member of Google Earth and the Google Maps team. James earned his PhD in computer science from the University of Alabama and his BS in computer science from Tianjin University in China. DeepMap is obviously a so-called HD mapping company for autonomous vehicle usage. They're accelerating safe autonomy by providing the world's best autonomous mapping solutions. DeepMap delivers the technology necessary for self-driving vehicles to navigate in a complex and unpredictable environment. They address 3 important elements: precise, high-definition mapping, ultra-accurate, real-time localization, and the serving infrastructure to support massive global scaling. Without a human driver, of course, self-driving cars will have to rely on maps with real-time localization to constantly update changes, you know, like road conditions, accidents, construction, and so on. You know, for cars to be able to maneuver autonomously, of course, they must be aware of all conditions around them. And well, DeepMap is solving this challenge by providing accurate and efficient prior knowledge of the world around the car. So collectively, the founders and the employees of DeepMap have built mapping technologies in use currently by tens of millions of people daily, including Google Maps and Apple Maps. The company's technical advisor board includes former Google, Uber, and Apple visionaries Brian McClendon and Jaron Waldman, as well as Dr. Leonidas Guibas, a prominent Stanford University professor, and Herman Kayas, former CEO of Bosch in Korea. In May of 2020, DeepMap was named a cool vendor in autonomous systems by Gartner, and I'd say that's putting it rather lightly. So they are a pretty big deal indeed. And again, I can't reiterate what a thrill and an honor, and indeed really what a pleasure it was to chat with James yesterday. So thrilled to get this episode published and out the door so quickly. Hope you're sitting comfortably. Episode 155 with Dr. James Wu, DeepMap.ai's CEO, begins now. Three, two, one, and we're live. Well, not live, obviously, but we are recording.
Yeah.
So, James, really great of you to join me today. Thanks so much indeed. I feel like we've been trying to schedule this forever, actually. So really great to finally connect with you. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, no, it's my pleasure. Look, you know, one of the really... I think fascinating facets about talking with folks on this podcast generally, and indeed in general, is of course understanding kind of the background, what led people to end up in this space. Obviously, I've been calling the autonomous vehicle space the greatest step change in humanity since the Industrial Revolution. Now, I guess it depends on one's point of view and how one wants to define that. But obviously, then I'd love to kind of just hand it off to you, understand sort of your background, how you ended up here at DeepMap, and just really eager to hear how you got here.
Sure, I can. That's a long story, right? I was a huge fan of computer science and programming and technology when I was a student. After my PhD study, I went to work for a tiny startup with three people. I was the first engineer. We are working on map product. That was 2002 or 2003, long, long time ago. And at that time, I think it was the first revolution of mapping technology, because the U.S. government make satellite imagery accessible and usable for commercial usage around that time, 2002 or 2003. I still remember the original name of the startup is called 1 meter, because they allow 1 meter resolution satellite imagery to be used by commercial usage.
So 1 meter back in 02. Yeah, that sounds remarkably high res. Yeah.
Yes, it's very high res.
I remember I had a flight simulator that it was a really big deal. It was down to 3 or 4 meters of resolution. I think it was one of the Microsoft Flight Sim versions back in the day for a few geographic areas.
Yeah. So I worked for that company. I realized, oh my goodness, this mapping industry will take off. Suddenly you can sit in front of your computer. You have like this kind of immediately zoom in and pan around and see this all the details on the ground. It's like almost like flying every day, right? You can actually see all these great pictures. And that's exactly when I first get involved in the mapping industry. And then later I worked for many other map companies, including Google Earth, Google Maps, and Apple Maps. And eventually, as we making the map more and more precise, and Google started this effort called Google X. And actually the original team, a lot of the original team came from Google Maps team, and they started building self-driving cars. And at that time, I was still making maps, but in 2015, right, I was grabbed into another company self-driving car project, and I was in charge of the HD map making. So if we look back, it seems all the dots connect, right? It seems like I have no escape, but probably will grab into the self-driving revolution anyway, one way or the other. So that's why that's why I'm here. And 4 years ago, I started a company with my co-founder, Mark Wheeler. We used to work together at Google for many years. And we both work on Google Maps. And specifically, we work together on a project called Google Earth Engine, later renamed Google Map Engine. What that product does is we create Google Earth and Google Map, and we have that capability to make maps. But there's a lot of organizations and even countries, right? They have tons of data, but they don't know how to make maps. So we're kind of using this kind of engine to enable them build maps.
Hey, just to build some sort of chronological context real quick. So was this before or after the time that Google acquired Keyhole, I think it was?
That's after the Keyhole acquisition.
Was it after? Okay.
Yeah, Keyhole acquisition is 2004, 2005, right?
Oh, yeah. Okay.
The engine effort is started in 2008, I guess. I can't remember.
Okay.
2009, 2008. But anyway, we worked on that. And so I was working on self-driving cars, building HD map for one company, right? I laid out the whole roadmap for the company, SVP, right? That's a look. If you want to build self-driving
cars. Nice pun.
building the HD map. This is like a 3-month plan. Mm-hmm. to 3-year plan mm-hmm. to 5-year plan. I'm going to do all this for you. No problem. You can count on me mm-hmm. on that. But my biggest question is, like, how can they roll out this kind of services, self-driving car services, in an affordable mm-hmm. way? Because we all know that Waymo has been working on this for a decade, right? And yeah. it's not like starting from scratch a decade. It's actually depend on a lot of previous work on self-driving car technologies. And also mm-hmm. Google's great infrastructure, Google Map engineers, data, code base, AI, everything. So it's very, very clear to me, self-driving car is a huge challenge, even for big companies like Google. And that's just one technology. That's one challenge, right, in the technology field. Well, there's another challenge, which is commercialization of this technology. How can right. you make this self-driving car into a product that people can afford and use once you get this past the technology barrier and the safety requirement, right? And making the self-driving car technology affordable means a lot. If you can't make it affordable, it's very difficult for somebody to give up a driver and then to use a self-driving car if the driver actually is cheaper, right? So,
right.
So this is kind of an economic problem as well. And we took a deep look into this kind of two challenges. For the first challenge, not every company can be as strong as Google or Waymo to attract all the talents that they need. So to solve the technology challenge, the first barrier is talents. You don't have enough expert,
of course,
for this domain. And so what we do is we look at that, okay, how we can be helpful. I remember I used to work with Mark on Map Engine. We said, we can build an engine. Right, we can assemble the best HD map team, and then we build this engine and serve everybody who want to be a self-driving car player in the industry, develop their own self-driving car technology, so that they don't need to hire the talent. Most time they can't even find this kind of enough talent to do this job for them. So we kind of try to enable them to do this job, right? So that's how we help solve the technical challenge and talent resource challenge for the self-driving car industry. Well, for the economic part, because this technology is so hard, you need to make this a very scalable product. You need to have tens of thousands, millions of cars eventually cover several major metropolitan regions or a huge geospatial region in order to make a business, right? You have like 200 miles of self-driving car test route. You can't make a business out of it, either robotaxi or delivery or whatever. You have to have enough coverage. And once you need to do that, we can reduce the cost for map making and map maintenance, because map making and map maintenance in the long run will be one of the cost center of self-driving car companies. You have to constantly update the map. Changing because the environment is changing, so you have to constantly changing, and the map is centimeter precise. That means you have a lot of data as well, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
A lot of data, a lot of computing, a lot of upload, downloading, compression, all this stuff, right? So we can help with that as well to leverage our engine to save money and enable everybody to play this game. That's mm-hmm. how we decide to start a company. I really try to help solve the one of the bottlenecks of the self-driving car industry.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, I had a chance to learn a little bit about this space in a bit more detail. CES 2019, I was invited out by HERE Technologies. And so I was doing a few days of moderating talks, and it's exactly the thing that you talked about, right? This notion of the need to constantly update all the data. And mm-hmm. I guess the idea is eventually, I mean, surely this is not the sort of volume of data that you guys can produce on your own with your own vehicles,
no.
But rather I'm assuming this is something where in the future, all vehicles will have the necessary kit, hardware, software stack as needed to constantly aggregate and indeed add to this database, which from which others can then benefit, correct?
Yes, exactly. So actually, we invented this terminology called HD map as a service.
Right. Yep.
Right. And we our slogan.
What is that? HD mass?
HD mass.
Right? HD mass. Let's just go with that.
Yeah, we used to call it mass mapping as a service. And you know, there's like a mobility as a service. So it's kind of confusing. So we don't say that much, but it's really HD map as a service. And our slogan is your data, your map. We get the data from the self-driving cars and we build a map for the self-driving cars. And while the car using the data, using the map, we update the map. So that's really a service. And this is our goal and target, especially for the full self-driving car, full autonomy industry, level four, level five. We want to become the HD map engine for all the players in the industry. And we are serving a lot of customers already. And for the other market, for level two and two plus market, where most of the cars don't have the capability to create a map by themselves, we also can help them by building a huge map covering the highways and most of the surface road so that they can drive safely on this kind of map.
With very I don't know the extent to which you can talk about companies that you're working with already, but it seems to me that, I mean, just sort of intuitively, as you mentioned, I mean, there's so much work that goes into all these different aspects of building even a semi-autonomous vehicle, let alone a fully autonomous one. I think about, for example, GM and how they've been trying to build out their Super Cruise technology. But if I'm not mistaken, they're developing their own mapping data as well. And so it kind of makes me wonder, why would any company want to do this on their own? It almost seems to me, to use a sort of silly analogy, it's almost to me seeming like, I don't know, rather than using, I guess, AWS, for instance, or whatever, you end up trying to host your own system, say. Like, why? Like, why would anybody today, already, as of 2020, try to do this on their own when there's folks like you? Like,
Exactly right. So,
I mean, unless they're a dedicated mapping company, too. Obviously, I get that. But they're not. They're GM.
I think GM is actually not building their own maps. They hire somebody else to build their maps.
Okay, that makes more sense. I didn't know that. Okay.
Usually the OEMs, they don't want to build their own maps. One of the reasons some of the companies building their own map is because our company is fairly new. We're only 4 years old, and a lot of company has been working on self-driving way before DeepMap even exists, right? So it's kind of like, and HD map is essential for self-driving. So before you even make the car drive on itself, you need to have a map. It's not only for driving, it's also necessary for simulation as well. A lot of the companies, even before their car's ready, they have to build a map somehow. That make them stick with their map. You know, once you have a map, switching over have some non-trivial amount of cost. I think, well, in the recent years, when there's new companies coming out building self-driving car, we see more and more of them just come direct to us or some other map companies looking for solutions, which is just reasonable in my opinion, right? And especially for our model, if you look at our business model, we are very, very flexible. We don't need to take the ownership of the data if the data came from our customer's car or just a service, right? Our customer almost have nothing to lose, but all the benefit.
Yeah.
They got the data, they got the map. They can forget about the map update problem, data versioning, all those issues, correctness, map correctness, and precision, how to maintain the precision and freshness. All this problem we solved for them with a fraction of the cost if they try to do this themselves. And for a lot of those customers, they probably even cannot do this themselves. They don't have the right talent and team to do this. And they're not a map business anyway, right?
Right, so, right.
So I was kidding with Mark, my co-founder, very often. Like, we're talking about a lot of the self-driving car companies. I think once they scale up, covering multiple cities and multiple places, they almost like to has to become a map company themselves if they don't use services like us. Right?
Yeah, that makes sense. No, I get that. Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm curious to ask about the data, though. I don't know. This might be beyond the scope of what you know what you feel like discussing, but just briefly, because we I don't know if you know, I'm actually a lawyer, a California licensed attorney, nice. And I just it's
have to be careful.
Mercifully, I'm not. mercifully, I'm the good kind. I'm not practicing right now. I'm doing all sorts of other fun things. But I did have the chance just a couple of weeks ago to teach a continuing legal education course with the Beverly Hills Bar Association and with one of my friends and colleagues. So we put on this course, and one of the recurring themes is, of course, the concept of obviously data security and privacy and all that sort of good stuff. And obviously it's a big issue with respect to mapping data. I just want to ask one really, really simple, well, I don't know, maybe it's not so simple, I guess, a sort of a high level question. Is there an easy way to answer this? If everybody's vehicle is effectively helping to aggregate data, which is then used by you guys, say, or indeed other companies who, for lack of a better word, license your data to use it however they see fit, is there or is there not an argument that we, the consumers, whose vehicle data is being used in some way should be perhaps eligible for some small trickle stream of revenue share from that data? Is there any valid argument there? Because it's a thing that's turned up. It's a thing we've heard. And again, I'm not even trying to get into the issue of privacy per se, but just insofar as, is there any monetary ownership with respect to that data, or is that even a valid argument?
I think it's a valid argument, actually, in the long run. And if I look at this from another perspective, I think this is already happening in a lot of places. So nowadays, there's a lot of, for example, there's a lot of free apps, a navigation app or location-based service app. It's free, you use it, but actually the data that you generated while using the app could worth some money, and the company actually making a revenue out of it.
Because, well, I know that's what companies are doing these days currently, but I've never heard of a situation where we, the consumer, get a cut of that, even though we're basically had it.
So if you look at, like, you don't have a cut of it, but you're using the service for free.
Well, sure. That's okay. That's valid. That's certainly
right?
True. Yes.
That's a value. Or, but, you know, I think that's just the easier business model than ask each customer or their users to have a cut of their revenue while pay for the service, right? That's like even more complicated today. In the self-driving car space, I think in the long run, that's also an interesting scenario to discuss. I see some things happening already. Like there's always this kind of a negotiation between suppliers and OEMs and customers. Like the OEMs may have a lot of data. And if the suppliers want to, tier one, tier two suppliers want to get their hand on the data, they have to reduce their cost of their service to the OEMs or component to the OEM. This is happening all the time already. So I think you have a very valid point, but how that value or the cut show up could be different.
Yeah, that's a really good point, actually. You're right, because even insofar as just suppose, for instance, just a basic GPS today had indeed really, you know, basically real-time updated data. I mean, truly real-time updated data. That already would indeed be a value because, of course. Yeah. And if it's aggregated from everybody. Yeah, I see that. That's a really good point. Yeah.
Yeah, it's very valuable. It shows the traffic, your pattern, where you like to go, and also a lot of location-based opportunities, business opportunities, right? So, I mean, I have been in the map industry for 17 years, so this is no surprise to me. I know location-based data actually has a lot of values. However, if you look at our business, we really try to help. We try to enable our customer. It's not like we're what try to take away our customer data and try to make money out of it. We just try to help our customer to move fast. I think that's the real motivation for us, because we believe self-driving cars is such a great technology. It will probably eliminate a lot of the car accidents and the injuries. And also this will free the human being from like constantly paying attention while they're driving. Like before the pandemic, I'm driving, like I'm spending at least an hour and a half every single day because of commute, right? And that's part of my life, right? It's gone. I couldn't have been doing more stuff doing that. And also there's so much automation we can do if we have robots actually deliver stuff here and there. We can probably solve the congestion problem if there's a lot of self-driving cars on the street, because we can actually schedule them, right?
Right, true.
So it's very, very beneficial. It's not just to one country or one company. It's beneficial to the whole world and the whole human species. And that's why we believe this will happen sooner or later. And we're working very hard toward that direction.
I mean, you don't have to convince me about that. I mean, indeed, the whole reason I'm not practicing law is precisely because I wanted to start this this consulting firm with a bunch of academics from around the world. And our whole purpose is indeed to try to do our part to sort of facilitate what we see as this massive gap as between technology in one hand and, let's face it, really just market deployment involving all the various facets of that, because it's a really difficult thing to get right. So let's actually... kind of shift gears then, I guess, and talk about AVs specifically as a whole, you know, the technology and kind of where we're at today, where we're headed. I got to ask though, quick aside for a moment, I'm just sort of connecting some dots in my head. So you were at Google and Apple working on mapping. I've got to throw out two names of some high school buddies of mine. I'm just curious if you know them, because they also were there around the same time as you, I think. Do the names Bill Chen or Anthony Lewandowski ring a bell?
Oh my goodness. Of course, Bill Chen was my buddy, and his office is right next to me. And when I was working at Apple, he's awesome. He's now one of the founding engineer of what's the name?
RideOS.
RideOS in San Francisco. Yeah. He's awesome. And of course, Lewandowski, right? He's very famous. Right?
Well, I meant besides that. I was trying not to go there. I meant personally.
He's very, very famous. And we actually have a few interactions with him before as well.
Yeah. This world is so tiny, this AV world. I mean, yeah, these are two of my good buddies in high school. And
really?
They're going to hate me for saying this. But we may have been responsible for starting the high school chess club. Please don't ever repeat that to anybody. I remember Bill actually, I think he practically learned every single chess opening. He was obsessed with this chess book, just every day, just memorizing every single opening. It was remarkable. I lost a 2-hour game to Anthony once, which was like the greatest loss I've ever had in a chess game. Yeah, fun times.
I have to say, which school did you go? This is an amazing school. You have so many.
Yeah, seriously, right? Yeah, no, this was, seriously, yeah. No, it was Tam High in Mill Valley.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, Mill Valley, just here in Marin County, across the Golden Gate. Okay. Yeah.
Awesome high school.
Seriously.
Your classmates are so amazing.
Yeah, you know, it's true. I'm always blown away to see what these guys went off and did. I mean, it's super, super cool. And obviously for me to sort of end up at least in some little capacity in this space with really no intent previously, just as a guy who always loved cars generally, and as a guy who spent most of his UCLA career studying engineering, it was just kind of like the perfect discovery of mine to kind of just fall into this space, you know, and it's just awesome. Such a great, fascinating field, obviously.
Who else in your high school actually also working in the self-driving car industry?
Gosh, good question. I think those are the only two that I know of off the top of my head. Okay. Why, is that not enough? Should there be more?
There could be more.
Yeah, there could be.
Right.
Awesome. Wow.
I actually know both of them.
I'm sorry?
I actually knew both of them very well. Actually.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, that's kind of what I figured. That's why I had to ask. I mean, again, such a small world. Yeah.
Yeah.
Very, very cool. All right. So yeah, let's talk then about AVs more broadly. I know it sounds a bit cliche to even ask the question, but I think it's worth briefly mentioning. Obviously, with everything that happened with COVID, the lockdown, et cetera, there's been a lot of negative, I guess, conversation about how it's having an adverse, a really negative impact on AV testing, deployment, whatever. I've tried to take a rather more positive view, suggesting that really this has been an optimal time to increase testing on public roads, if only because, well, you've got less usage by pedestrians mm-hmm. and indeed certainly cars. Okay, granted, perhaps the data set is a bit suboptimal, less cars, less pedestrians to worry about, but it's a non-zero benefit, right?
Right, right.
I mean, what Absolutely. Do you think?
Yes, we actually drove around testing our mapping vehicles, mapping rigs. We noticed there was nobody on the street for a lot of the streets, right? Yeah. Which is a great time to map, actually.
Yeah, I guess so, exactly.
I agree with that. I think the coronavirus situation is actually a reminder of the industry that actually self-driving car is not something nice to have. Sometimes it's necessary, right? Especially for this kind of a pandemic situation, we couldn't do shopping like before for a long period of time. And we're kind of worried about getting contact with other human beings and get these diseases. I have my mother-in-law living with us, and we're deeply worried about her situation if we ever, one of us, get the virus, bring the virus to home, right?
No, so, I know what you mean. My parents are in their 80s, and, you know, that's been exactly the concern for my wife and for me, and of course my wife's family, who are all the way in Romania, that we can't even help out with. And indeed, it is this concern that if, you know, I feel like the future has got here and we're not ready for it yet. I mean, future in a negative sense. Like, here's this terrible, terrible hurdle, and we're not quite prepared for it, because ride sharing in a truly driverless car, that would have been the optimal solution, obviously, and we're just not quite ready.
Yeah, we're not right.
And it's super frustrating.
I think one way is frustrating. The other is, I think this is accelerating. It's almost like a push to people.
Yes, it's sort of a catalyst in a crazy sort of way.
Yes, it's like we need to have a contactless delivery. Yep. We need to have, so think of this way. Like, we're talking about delivery, grocery stuff from the supermarket to my home. That's one thing. The other thing is, like, how about the hospitals? They need supplies. Who's going to deliver to them? And it's almost like it's too risky. And also other places that are dangerous could be the source of the virus. I mean, these kind of things require self-driving technology to develop faster. We believe, of course, the pandemic is a horrible situation for the economy, but this wake up people's mind. They need to think about what the self-driving car means. It's just not limited to what we used to thought about, right? This is critical for health and safety related issue as well.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I mean, I feel like history has often shown that the worst of times often bring about the greatest innovations out of necessity. Exactly.
I believe, and also this is, in certain sense, for us, it's a good thing, because this kind of a slowdown in business, and of course, because of this kind of a pandemic situation, investment slows down, and most of the companies, they need to sit back and rethink about their strategy dealing with this kind of a economy slowdown, and they need to take a hard look at their burn, cost-saving effort, and also take a hard look, to estimate their go-to-market speed of their product. So for self-driving car technology, there's a long investment cycle and huge amount of upfront investment, right? I think we should seriously thinking about how we can make this easier, like less burn, faster go to market speed, right? Yeah. To get the product to the market sooner. so that I think one way we believe to solve this problem is collaboration.
So you took the words out of my mouth, and that, because that's exactly what we're seeing everybody do, right? So I feel like all these smaller kind of techie AV companies, they're realizing, we probably can't build an actual car. And all the car companies are saying, we kind of don't have the necessary brain power to build AV hardware software stacks. And so, yeah, everyone's kind of pairing off, partnering up like a high school dance sort of, you know?
Nothing is easy, I have to say. We are very humble. We know the self-driving car technology is very hard. We have some of the best mapping engineers in the industry. And we're still working super hard just to help customers solving their mapping problems and localization problems, this kind of issues, right? The overall self-driving car technology is really, really challenging. It's according to Tim Cook, this is the mother of all the AI problems.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
It's really challenging. And for this kind of challenging task, it's require more collaboration, deeper collaboration, right? Wide collaboration. And we're very open and flexible for this kind of collaboration. We're ready. We're helping a lot of customers to move super fast and get over the hurdle that's slowing them down.
Right. Mm-hmm. So, well, okay. So let's talk about what that deployment looks like. I guess what I would love to ask you is, so I've had this kind of really strong belief for a while that one of the biggest hurdles to, I guess, fast tracking autonomous vehicle, well, testing and deployment really, is that I sort of feel that there's too much focus on kind of the ultimate end game of level 5 cars. Meaning, to me, it seems that if companies would just focus more on level 4 cars and treat them as what I call, let's face it, a level 4 car is effectively a virtual train of sorts, in the sense that it can maybe only go on certain roads here and there, maybe certain conditions, right? Yeah. I just feel like if that were the focus rather than level 5, I feel like things could be accelerated quite a bit. And I just think that that would be an incredible goal on its own. And I don't know. I'm curious what you think. Does that make sense to you as well, or do you disagree?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. I totally agree with you on this. I think level 5 technology is a great motivation.
Right.
But as I mentioned, let's talk about level 5 robotaxi, right? The upfront investment, the return cycle, the go-to-market speed is all very, very big challenges, even for a giant,
right, exactly,
very, very successful company like Google, right, and Apple.
Yep.
So I think I totally agree with you. I believe the whole industry is moving toward where you just described. So there's this new terminology called level 2++.
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like a level 4 system, but, you know, it's just not level 3, level 4. You still need a driver, but it's getting smarter and smarter and safer, right? I think that's one way to get the self-driving car technology into the consumer vehicle before it's level 5 ready.
Right.
Right? Right. That's that one direction. Sense. There's also this kind of a hub-to-hub trucking applications, a limit into fixed route, no passenger conditions, right? Highway, hub-to-hub conditions, much easier than the urban or metropolitan environment. I think that's dramatically reduced the complexity and difficulty of the problem.
Mm-hmm.
There's also this kind of low-speed delivery vehicles that you can just stop right there and wait until the environment clear up, or you can switch over in the remote control. To drive it remotely, slowly, in a safe way, right?
I mean, I'm picturing Nuro's little delivery box. What is it? R2, I think.
Right. I mean, there's plenty of this kind of company working on this already. Because I'm in this industry, a lot of our customers already doing this kind of things. And there's also, we have a lot of my friends running their own companies helping in this in these domain as well. So I think the industry is moving that direction. And potentially the future winner could be one of those players as well.
Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. As they roll out their product first, right?
Yeah, yeah. And I think this kind of syncs up with what you said earlier. One of the big concerns, I guess, you know, as a, you know, I was in startup world for like 8 years. I mean, I know what it's like to raise a Series A. Basically, as we all know, it sucks. It's miserable and awful. And, you know, and I think the big concern is that I feel like, and I could be wrong about this, but it just, it seems like AV technology is, again, it in light of everything we're discussing, it's almost getting lumped into the sort of, gosh, this is like a 10, 20 year return thing, sort of like biotech. And we know how excited Silicon Valley is about like 10, 20 year timeframes for, you know, getting anything out of a biotech investment. And like, I just think that would be a real shame if it gets lumped into there. On the flip side, to your point about more and more companies cooperating, working together, that should help avoid lumping AV into this, you know, pipe dream of sorts. Yeah, I think that's the big concern going around, right? Everyone's saying, oh, was everybody wrong? And I said the other day, I don't think it's fair to say that people were wrong. It was more about, you know, with respect to time frame, right? I think it was rather more along the lines of, gosh, it's just a much more complicated thing than we realized. And so, as you say, now we've got to adapt. And that means much more collaboration.
Yeah, I think the challenge is how can we bring the future to now faster, right?
Yeah, exactly. So
that's exactly why we started DeepMap. I know there will be some company like this has to exist to help people solve the HDMap problem in a scalable and economic way. But I don't know who's going to build it, right? And I can't sit there and wait for somebody to build this kind of service like 4 years later. I have to do it. And of course, there's challenges and risks. I used to work for big companies, right? I have almost no risk. I was a fairly good engineer, very well paid, very stable job. But I think it's worth the effort to try to bring the future closer by a year or two or somehow.
Yeah,
right? This is kind of the motivation that drive me to work super hard every single day, try to get where we want to be. So we want to drive the price and the cost of the HD map and maintenance as cheap as possible. I think a lot of the OEMs and self-driving car players, one of the reasons they can't use HD map or they don't want to use HD map is not like they don't like it. It's just too expensive for them to use. For some of them, right? They can't afford. They're selling a consumer vehicle and they can't afford a super expensive map, like the Waymo type of map. However, if we can reduce the price of the map to pennies per mile, that will be very affordable. And why people don't want to use it, right? Once you have this kind of a high precision map accessible and is almost free, Why don't people use it? It just make your car so much safer.
Right. No, of course. But I have a question though. I mean, isn't there the possibility of presuming a truly autonomous vehicle future? And now really looking at level 5, ironically, even though I just said not to, but that true autonomous vehicle future with no steering wheel and so forth, doesn't this presume precisely that individuals, in fact, must not own the cars anymore. And so therefore, any additional costs should be less of an issue because now the cost is being, you know, the burden of the cost is rather on, say, robo-taxi fleets rather than individuals, right? And so presumably, cost will always be an issue regardless who has to buy it. But I mean, it's less of a sensitive cost than it would be for an individual today, no?
I think in general that is right, right? Once the car can drive itself and you won't be able to utilize the car all the time, so it makes little sense for you to really own the vehicle yourself.
Right, it must be shared, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it could be shared, but in my opinion, there's still a huge need for certain people to just own vehicles. Like I'm a father, I have two kids. You know, I have a lot of stuff in my car, and I still need a car.
That's valid.
I just can't imagine without a car. I mean, just I don't know about you. I live through this for a family. At least I need a pretty big van.
Yeah, that's a valid point. I guess I don't know what it's like to have any kids yet, but I guess I'll get there soon.
Yeah, I mean, that's very important for us. And I think the ownership of car will probably drop. Like you,
right.
Even for a family with kids, if we can have one car just for our family out and doing some kids-related stuff, if it's self-driving, it's even better, right? I mean, I can send the car empty to pick up my kids from school.
Absolutely.
I just can't wait for that to happen, right?
Seriously, that would be pretty great. I can imagine.
Right. And also when you don't have a driver, you don't have to drive, you can actually enjoy a meal or just drink some wine inside the car. I believe the wine industry will have a boost.
Absolutely. No, for sure. Actually, it's funny. We've been conducting this survey with our company for the last several months, trying to get a real sense of what we call just so-called consumer acceptance of autonomous vehicles. And of course, that's one of the questions. All the various things people would enjoy doing in a car, and it just opens up a tremendous amount of freedom. Obviously, the sort of freedom where I think, without any doubt, once this reality is with us, mm-hmm. People will imagine, how did we ever live without it? Obviously, it's one way.
Once you get used to it, you just can't get rid of it anymore.
Yep, exactly. Hey, so I have a somewhat more tech question to ask, at least at a high level. I'm just kind of curious. One of the kind of questions that gets thrown around a lot, again, almost to the point that it's become a bit of a cliche, so sorry for asking, 5G. Right. Is this or is it not, in fact, a necessary condition for a connected autonomous future?
First, I think 5G is something that we can't avoid. It will happen anyway.
I totally agree with. Absolutely. Right.
So is it an absolute necessity for self-driving cars? I'm not sure about that, actually. But will that be useful? Absolutely, right? It will be very, very helpful. There's a couple
of things. The issue being what? The lower latency? Because surely it's not just a bandwidth issue, right? It's just the primary benefit is the lower latency, no?
The latency is very good, right? I mean, the lower latency is very, very helpful, because when you remote control a vehicle, the latency...
bad latency is terrible for first-person shooter, too. So don't want bad latency for remote operation.
Yeah, that's one thing. The other thing is the bandwidth, right?
Yeah.
These two things always come together. With higher bandwidth, you got a much better channel to get the car connected with the cloud and the control center. You just have a much faster rate of data exchange. Mm-hmm. The more data you have in the car, it's safer. And also, because 5G will have a lot of base stations, this will help dramatically with not only data exchange, but also vehicle localization, a very high precision localization as well. There's multiple benefits for that, for sure. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay. Fair enough.
We think this 5G is definitely going to help the self-driving car deployment.
Yeah, but I guess with respect to the limited range, I guess. I mean, you're right. You would need a ton of additional base stations and cell towers generally, right? So, I mean, doesn't that raise the concern of just how impractical it's going to be to build out a sufficient coverage before it even has any value, right?
I'll say the other way, right? So 5G is not just for self-driving cars. People want to use 5G technology already, right? There's a lot of plenty of other applications for 5G.
I mean, don't get me wrong. I would love to have 5G right now. Absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, you probably can't stop it anyway. So, I mean, your next generation phone will probably have 5G on it.
Yeah.
And the self-driving car will just take advantage of it. And to us, it's almost like, okay, maybe I'm just thinking, right? Nobody knows what happened. If you have 5G regions, your redundancy system is so much safer, you can really turn your car into a level 5 system. If you run out of the 5G region, then maybe it's a ADAS system or level 2, level 3.
I see. That's an interesting point. Yeah.
Yeah. So something like that could happen down the road.
That reminds me, sorry, this is sort of an aside, but do you see any reality where there's kind of an in-between time zone, kind of like an interim state, I guess between, like, I guess somewhere between level 3 and level 5, maybe between level 4 and level 5, where there's a market for, I don't even know what to call it, like backup teleoperation drivers on demand? Effectively, if that makes any sense. So
operators? I don't know if I got.
Yeah, exactly. So remote operators, but sort of only when needed, kind of on demand. We're like that. You've got a bunch of backup drivers, kind of on standby, just and whenever there's a vehicle that needs assistance, suddenly gets paired. A remote driver might get paired up with that particular vehicle. Is that a reality that makes sense, you think, to kind of bridge the gap as between say a level 3, level 4 future and a fully level 5 future?
I believe so, actually. This is already happening for some of the delivering vehicle startups. And just tell you what I learned. Actually, this kind of a what we call operation center or call center, right?
For the self-driving vehicle. Exactly. Yeah.
This is actually a very common thing in the train industry, I learned.
Long time ago.
Yes. So this is fascinating. I had a friend serving the train industry for a long time. He told me that actually in the train industry, the train is pretty much self-driving most of the time.
So, well, I know that I'm very good steering input. That's true.
It's self-driving, and you also have a driver in it. But you know, think about what the driver can do. Right? It's very limited.
Not very much.
And actually, a lot of the trains in North America, I think they have a very good high-speed connections so that, you know, for emergency control and brakes and this kind of things.
Interesting. I didn't know that.
So there's actually operation centers to dealing with all these trains remotely. Huh. Control them, stop them, start them, this kind of things, right? There's companies providing this kind of device and services for the train industry. I mean, if you look at the self-driving cars, robot taxi or deliveries, it's almost like a tiny train, self-driving train, right?
So that's actually what I was suggesting earlier. Exactly. You've got these sort of virtual trains. And I think that's the point that if consumers stop seeing autonomous cars as, well, cars that drive themselves, but rather just a different type of train, I think that makes it a lot easier to accept for those people who are not willing to accept them otherwise.
Exactly. I mean, I totally can envision that the operation of remote operating self-driving cars could be a good business as well. There's been plenty of companies doing that already.
I mean, I know it's used a lot for backup driving, certainly. And of course, we all heard the sad story about Starsky. And I recently got acquainted with some folks over at a company called Chibus. So I get it. And that's kind of why I was asking. I was just sort of curious where that falls into all this, you know?
Yeah, I think so, that's going to happen. There will be backup operators.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, okay. So I guess, let's go back then more kind of to the work that you guys are doing with all this data. I wanted to ask about, I'm glad that that's all the development and kind of all the regulation is effectively in states' hands. At what point do you think it'd be good for federal regulation to take over? Because I always use analogies for aviation. I'm a huge, as they say, av geek. I love aviation as well and everything aircraft. And I just think there's so much to be learned from the aviation world. And I've often said that thanks to organizations like the FAA and the ICAO or IATA internationally, this is why aircraft are the safest place you can be within the globe, you know?
Right, exactly.
So what do you think about this need that I've often suggested that, you know, at least for level 4 and level 5 vehicles, we need some sort of standards, both with respect to cars, technology, roads, you know, markings, this, that, the other, to facilitate self-driving cars generally. With respect to level 4 cars, for instance, why not just start to dedicate certain lanes on certain roads or certain lanes on freeways, that sort of thing? So
yeah,
federal regulation generally, good idea?
Yeah. So this is funny because I was invited to a conference and some of the government officials are there from the Department of Transportation. And I actually was calling for more regulations in the self-driving car
that's
space.
Awesome to hear.
And then the officer told me I was the first guy from the startup world actually
I was going to tell you the same thing. I've never heard anyone say that, which is exactly why I was asking you. Oh, okay, then.
Actually, I believe in good regulations to promote innovation, right? So how do we define good regulation? It's very difficult to define. In my opinion, nobody knows what is the right way to regulate some new technology before people really understand the consequences and the application of the technology. It's very difficult to predict that. So almost always regulation is lagging behind the technology and the applications, right? So in one sense, people are right. We don't want to have regulation to block innovation. So just let them grow. But on the other hand, regulation can be really helpful if they can set up some boundaries for the new technology to try and fail, right?
Yeah.
So, for example, the self-driving lane in certain places, I think that will be an awesome experiment. And even like for a certain city, for example, we can draw a circle of that city. Within that city, you know, it's a self-driving zone, right? Be careful, there will be self-driving cars. We can warn anybody get into that zone and give people more. Of course, we still need to guarantee the safety. We can't compromise the safety, but just let people have some place to test and deploy their technology and try and fail. And I think
that's exactly right. Yeah, you got to push that limit to see where exactly.
Mm-hmm. Right, and also give some guidance on the whole industry, how we can help each other, right? For example, collaboration, promote collaboration, promote some insurance company to come up with a self-driving car insurance, right? This is actually a non-trivial issue. What happens when there's accident, right? There should be an insurance cover because nothing will guarantee 100% safe or always work. There's nothing like that, right? There's always accident. And how do we deal with those? I think this kind of saying the government and the regulators could help dramatically, right? This can help dramatically. So that's that type of regulation I ask for. That's kind of my idea.
Okay, awesome. Yeah, that is refreshing to hear. Yeah, with respect to insurance generally, that is a discussion that turns up a lot, obviously. And I think, again, if we're looking at just level five, certainly it's not an issue for the operator of the vehicle because they're just a passenger, right? And I guess in that case, everything just shifts, the burden shifts to the... I mean, again, it's like aviation, right? Nobody ever questions whether a passenger is at fault for when an airplane crashes. It goes first to the pilots and then to the manufacturers, right? So same thing here. I mean, I don't really see the difference, actually, between an airplane and an autonomous car, apart from, I don't know, one's got wings and one has wheels. I mean, it sounds silly, but it's kind of true, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I believe the self-driving car industry will learn a lot from the aviation industry and grow more and more similar to that as well.
Yeah.
There will be more and more guidance or regulations to strictly guide it. And also it will be very, very safe as well, just like the aviation industry, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Did you see this weird report the other day? I actually haven't read it yet, but I've been seeing it everywhere. Something about, it almost sounds like a complaint, like a critique, that autonomous cars will only reduce traffic deaths by one third. Have you seen this?
Yes. I saw that.
I mean, like I said, I didn't bother to read it yet. I absolutely intend to read it. But to me, if indeed the point of the article is to sort of, to critique the promise of an autonomous vehicle future by saying they will only reduce deaths by one third, that I just don't see the point of that. I mean, okay, if it's one third reduction, I'll take it.
I haven't read through the article yet. I just got the link the other day. I haven't got the chance to look through this. But even one third is a huge amount of people's lives.
Exactly. That's my point. Exactly. Yeah.
We can't measure people's lives, the cost of people's lives, right?
I mean, exactly. Hey, James, I just realized, with respect for your time, we only have about 5 minutes left. Do you have any overtime available, or are we a hard stop?
Yeah, of course.
5 minutes.
I have overtime, no problem.
Okay, we'll go a little over. I promise not to keep you too long, but I want to bring it back, frankly, to you guys specifically at DeepMap. Just the overarching question. I would love to understand, to really, you know, get a holistic sense of what you guys are up to. I mean, with respect to kind of the biggest challenges facing you today, and kind of where you're headed next. I mean, how do you, you know, what are indeed some of the things that really just, gosh, this is difficult. We've got to figure this out. Because indeed, as you say, mapping as a whole is a very challenging thing. Mm-hmm. But are there some particular elements that are just, you know, wow, how can we improve this sort of a thing?
Yeah, we're facing challenges every single day, and we're very, very busy as well. In terms of biggest challenge, I would say at this stage, during the shelter-in-place and shutdown, our biggest challenge that we're focusing on is how to dramatically scale up our operation. Mm. And once you do a dramatic scale up your operation, a lot of small issues before you had will become obviously a bottleneck or a big issue.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, true.
So we are working super hard to get rid of all these bottlenecks one by one, so that we can scale our whole system. And mm-hmm. The scale also need a lot of automation.
Right.
Because we will try to get rid of all the manual steps and the interventions or inefficiencies between pipelines. We try to get it as smooth as possible.
I was about to ask you about that, the manual steps. It just reminded me, didn't Google Images back in the day have a sort of, I mean, kind of a game where if you were browsing Google Images, it would ask you, hey, what is this image? And you would have to pick an answer. I vaguely remember this. And if I'm correct, if I remember this correctly, okay, good. So I'm not imagining things. I wonder, does it make
sense? They were using Street View data to check if you're a robot or a real human being.
I mean, there was that too, but I think there was they were trying to do like a training, like a data set training.
Yeah.
Right? Okay. So
whatever you generate could be used as a training data as well.
So what I'm wondering is, I mean, there is still this manual kind of human layer, right? I'm guessing mm-hmm. with the data. So is there any reality where you can effectively open it up for people more broadly, just in the general public, to kind of do what Google did, right? Helping train that data?
You mean for perception, self-driving cars?
Sure. My understanding is that a lot of the mapping data has to be properly tagged and labeled accordingly, right? And that still requires that human layer, right? So does it make sense to kind of open that up to everybody?
Open up to everybody in depending on what sense, right? So if you look at the company like Tesla, right, their driver is actually generating a lot of training data for them as well.
Well, that's true.
So mm-hmm. corner cases, right? So, and if you look at Google, a company like Google, right, when you search and click the links, you can also generate training data.
True.
So a lot of human actions actually are training data. If we do it right, what human did is really good training data for the robots and AI.
Yeah, right. True. So, I guess it was me in terms of actually helping to label some of the actual imagery, because I thought that was still an issue. That still it's the case,
yes.
Right?
Yes. Okay. There's a lot of company doing that right now. Actually, just to generate training data using overseas operation team, and we also have a small operation team helping us not just create the training data, but also QA our map as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, it's a human is a necessary component of the pipeline, but our goal is try to make the human as efficient as possible, right? Mm-hmm. 10, mm-hmm. 100, 1,000 times more efficient every month or things like that. Just mm-hmm. try to keep pushing the limit.
Right. So I have two kind of big questions I've been dying to ask in no particular order. So question number one is, it seems to me that if eventually we have the sort of HD mapping data that the folks like DeepMap are producing, and indeed if more and more companies rely on this, which it seems obvious they should be, I mean, because why not? And if computer vision, AI-powered computer vision for cameras gets sufficiently good, does that in fact suggest that potentially LiDAR will not in fact be necessary one day?
You mean LiDAR or map?
LiDAR. I mean, if you have sufficiently good computer vision cameras and you have sufficiently good mapping, then is it possible that LiDAR will in fact not be necessary one day?
I think it's totally possible, but you know, there's like a time frame, right?
Yeah.
There's a time frame and also the cost effectiveness during this time frame if you want to use LiDAR or not. So, and also there's this kind of a, how do I say, the boundary between sensors getting blurry nowadays. If you look at, follow the sensor industry closely, there's like mechanical LiDARs, so spinning, right? There's also flash, solid state. If you look at the flash and solid state LiDAR, they are more like, they give you an image.
Yeah, that's true. I've noticed that. It is almost a camera. That's true.
Yeah, so it's almost, you're looking like a sharp image with depth information on it. So that's one way. The other way is
there's a good point.
Kind of a structured lighting with camera. These two things work together. It's almost like a LiDAR, right?
So,
you know, once you have a structured lighting and you have a camera to see the structures, the light projected, then you can actually use that to estimate the depths. And also there's a lot of just the pure camera-based passive lighting cameras, right? To capture the structure as well, structure for motion or dense stereo, this kind of approach to estimate depths. So I think the boundary between LiDAR and camera, and there's also imaging radar, 3D imaging radar, right? And also the LiDAR gets smarter as well. There's like this frequency modulated LiDAR that you can estimate the speed of stuff that you can capture on the LiDAR, not just the distance, but speed, right? This is more like a radar.
Yeah, exactly.
so the boundary between all these sensors are blurry, in my opinion. Which one will win out? It's hard to say. I think all these, not a single sensor has no limits. Every sensor has their own limits. And the industry needs redundancy and safety and also affordability, economics, right? So we have to consider all those reasons. So it's pretty hard to predict when the camera will be good enough that LiDAR is not necessary, or maybe when the LiDAR is cheap enough that it just doesn't make any sense to not use one.
Yeah, you know what's funny is, you're right. I guess now that I'm having this discussion with you about this topic, I guess it's kind of a silly question. I mean, at the end of the day, who really cares? And I guess it kind of goes back to the question of standardizations, right? As long as you're using, I mean, who cares if you're using LiDAR popsicles or flowers to measure your distance to something? I mean, as long as it all works well enough, isn't that all that matters?
Yes. And also there's all kind of conditions, right? The lighting condition can change.
Exactly.
So the camera will have limits on there, and the weather condition can change. Radar and LiDAR could be helpful for some of this kind of corner cases. And for the safety of the system, maybe for a safety critical system, you have to use more sensors. Well, for a less safety critical system or a lower level self-driving system, maybe you can afford to not use all the sensors. I don't know. This could happen. This is like a trade-off.
Yeah.
Balance.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Yeah.
So I guess my last thing, just wanted to open it up to you. I mean, I was meaning to ask you earlier, but if you felt like sharing any of the latest kind of news or developments about DeepMap and any of your partners that you can talk with, any of your customers, you know, certainly happy to open it up to you and share anything you'd like at this point about that.
Sure. We're working with a lot of customers right now and helping them to move fast with their mapping needs and self-driving car needs. And also we're hiring actually. This is like a pandemic situation, but you know, we believe talents are the most people are the most valuable asset for our company, for DeepMap, and we care a lot about that. And we We're looking for very experienced product managers, especially with background knowledge in the self-driving car space and the mapping space. And we're also hiring a very experienced radar engineer. We have a few openings, and if people are interested, if I have friends interested in this kind of positions, I'd love to talk to them. We are very.
And you guys are based here in the Bay Area, right?
Yes, we're based in Bay Area, near Palo Alto, right? We have a lot of perks, and we have a very open and transparent culture that people loves. Check us out, right?
Well, there you go.
Yes.
Awesome. No, this is great. Well, look, by the way, as an aside, please feel free, if there's any folks you see on my LinkedIn you'd like an intro to, I'm more than happy to help do that for you. So just say the word.
I'll try to reach out to Bill as well.
Yeah, you should. You know, we it's funny. He and I lost contact. You know, I went to UCLA, he went to Berkeley, and then we kind of lost contact. We kind of touched base a few times in the last couple of years only, believe it or not. So
Amazing. Small world.
Yeah, definitely. Small world. Say hi. He'll get a kick out of it.
Yeah, we'll talk about this.
Yeah. Well, cool, James. Well, look, this has been absolutely fantastic. Really great, obviously, to connect finally, as I say. I feel like we've been trying to plan this forever. So thanks again so much.
Thank you so much.
And of course, it's my pleasure. And I'm more than happy to have you back on in a few months and learn more about all the progress you guys have made.
Okay, great. Great. Thank you.
All right. Well, take care. Stay safe. We'll talk soon.
Yeah. Bye.
Bye-bye. All right, well, that is a wrap for today, and indeed this week. Just a friendly reminder that coming up next week, we've got another fantastic guest that I'm actually recording today, just a couple of hours. His name is Dmitry Shevelenko, and he is the co-founder and president of a little Silicon Valley company called Tortoise. If that name sounds at all familiar, well, yeah, it's because you recently probably read about them in the news. They are bringing the magic and wonder of, well, autonomous mobility to your favorite e-mobility scooters. Yeah, imagine this, a fleet, or is that a flock, or perhaps a swarm of e-scooters autonomously riding themselves to you when you summon one, and in the reverse, when you get off one, when you end your ride, they then shuttle off to their designated parking spots. Sounds like something out of science fiction, and I can't wait to learn all about them. So if all goes according to plan, my chat with Dmitry should go live next Tuesday, the 16th. So until then, thank you again so much for listening. Have a wonderful weekend. Take care. Bye-bye.